What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since the camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics, activism and action.
And there's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on! It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping to the one place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my God.
All right, welcome to this edition of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with me, my trepid co-host, Michael Walsh.
Hello. This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective. For the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. A left that is of itself and for itself the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts.
Excellent job. So this show is about trying to find a synthesis, because when the left's greatest weakness is sectarianism to me. It's something that seems definitely ever present. I've been an activist in left-wing spaces for 10 years on now, and it's ever present in every kind of space. There's always either the threat of it, or it's hanging there like, let's not be sectarian. How do we stay united? There's always this conversation, and for even 200 years, it doesn't seem like there's been a solution to it. It seems that tribalism or lack of good communication seems to be one of those prerequisites of our education system, our society. It seems intrinsic. As long as we're a Western, European-based, you know, Enlightenment, Renaissance-based civilization, it seems like this whole building a new civilization that is, say, socialist, equitable, whatever we want, would be better. Doesn't seem to be possible within this world. Like, you know, build a new world in the shell. The old, well, it seems like the shell is actually an inhibitor to that. But that's just the big picture. You know, do we have to burn everything down before we can build anything good? Obviously, that's not the case. Solarpunk futures are coming about every day in various small ways, but can we actually organize something new on a societal basis? That seems to be an open question that we'll be exploring as we talk more about the types of sectarianisms on the left. So last time it was more in the role of the state sort of stuff, yeah, you know, between Leninists and Trotskyists from the first half and the second half of the 20th century stuff. We're in the 21st century. What are the things leftists fight about now? Well, sex, gender, social stuff, and intersectionality and its meaning, class. Bring back class politics. How do we do that without repeating the mistakes of Marxists in the 20th century, right?
Right.
There's thinking from post-Marxists. That's kind of where the class reductionism is really coming from, in my opinion. We'll explore that too. But first, let's tackle the SWERFs, which stands for the Sex Worker Exclusionary Radical Feminist. So these are the types of feminism / radical thought from the 60s and 70s, post-Marxian, which is we're not going to talk about or think about things in class dynamics anymore, kind of just more look at things in more moral terms, and thus it becomes more self-righteous and exclusionary to those who don't fit certain moral precepts, like all sex is exploitative if you're a woman, those kind of dynamics of a thought pattern. But in trying to fight sectarianism, I've joined a Facebook group, because that's where all great synthesis is made, right? I don't know.
Of course.
But it always feels like I always thought I was in a synthesis type of group, Occupy or something like that. But it actually kind of succumbed to sectarianism in various ways. Maybe because there was no unifying value system, even though it seemed like we assumed that there was. even in organizations that are small and petite, you know, it seems like you can only really have a good unified group if it's the 12-person cooperative, something like that. So, and even then, two people have a bad, rough relationship, and then it all falls apart.
Well, I was watching The Life of Brian last night, and yes, they have...
That's the common joke that people bring up.
They have a fantastic bit about leftist sectarianism and about splitters. People's Front of Judea? No! We're the Judean
People's Front! Because in the 60s, there literally was 5-10 different groups that all have names that were one word apart. And some of them still exist. There's Socialist Workers Party, and there's Party for Peace and Liberation. Mm. There's the SPUS, and there's the, you know, USSP or something.
There's also the SA.
The DSA, which has more, you know, that's the one people are going to, new members, more than others. So DSA is on people's radar, but otherwise, so they're growing and thus, but then it's a bit sectarian because you have all these caucuses in there that are all kind of vying for some kind of control and influence. Some of them are very revolutionary.
Right.
But then it becomes really impotent that the leadership is still just, we endorse Democrats, or we're, now that Biden, Bernie's out, we're not going to endorse anybody.
Ugh.
And all the other chapters are pretty much following that lead. They're like, no, we're not going to do electoralism for the rest of the year.
I tried to, I was on a DSA Zoom call, I think about like 2 months ago, and it was just a lot of talk about nothing, really. Like, it was just, I feel like there's more stuff actually going on in the Green Party meetings that I go to than in that DSA meeting that I went to.
Yeah, I went to a few DSA meetings a few years ago when they were getting that first big burst, so I wanted to check it out.
Right.
Some of them were RPI grads or people at RPI or other college student age and more interested. They weren't real. They were still baby leftists themselves, like you were, but 4 years ago. And I could already see like they were going to melt away. Like they were just checking it out, but they had never actually done any action before. And based on the leadership that was present, the 5-person team, it's like, either they have to hold their hands, you know, and manage them like if it's like it's a workplace or something.
Right.
You know, the initiative of coming is different than the initiative of joining or taking on a responsibility and taking a commitment, which is
also
very alien to people. It's like, because even if they don't admit it, there's still a what's in it for me. What am I going to get in the long run?
Right.
But of course, what you're going to get is a change in policy if you work at it hard enough or for long enough. You don't have to work hard, just longer. It's not going to come instantly. It's not going to come after a few months. It's kind of a thing you have to work at for years, because the organizing work, building trust, relationships, that is a, you know, even if it is just doing the social stuff and say like you earn some money with a career or something, then you can donate or be a dues-paying member regularly.
Right.
So let's get to, so the page is called, that I joined, is called Sincere Left Unity Discussion. Which is pretty new, at least in my eyes, because you have all these other leftist pages of different names. There's all this cross-pollination happening, but there's also a lot of trolling, bad faith and interpretation, people looking to just argue. I don't know really what is behind it. There's all kinds of impositions we can put on. They were just trained to just see everything as a conflict.
Right.
They're not trained to be nice. There's all this kind of skills and meta skills that we're just not taught based on where you live or what kind of family life or schooling you have. Like, it's like you know it's all wrong, but you still don't know anything else.
Yeah.
And then like you go to like say a hippie festival or a rainbow fest or something where everything is the opposite, and it's so alien, weird, it weirds you out.
Yeah.
I've felt that all the time when I hang around with crust punks or whatever. Just like how different they live from the rest of society almost. But it's all so separate, and you don't want to be entirely separate from everything you know.
Right.
Even if that's some of the stuff you know is toxic.
Like, you just want to make the society that already exists better. Like that's
but then it's
I
like, I don't know how, and I'm going to call people names online.
Yeah.
And that's where you lose me. And that's where it's like, there needs to be some kind of psychological mass study happening. But that takes some money and resources.
I saw a funny meme, and it was of a woman and like a dilapidated person who is facing all sorts of issues. And it's like, honey, it's time for your daily leftist infighting session. And the guy's like, please, I just want to help make people better and help make improve society.
You just kind of need a mantra of like, no fighting. I'm not going to fight with anyone. I'm going to be kind. Everyone's fighting their own battles. Everyone is oppressed like me.
Comrades are comrades.
Yes. It's like, what are we really disagreeing about? And that's kind of the thing about the joke from Life of Brian, is that it's never even hinted at, because it would ruin the joke,
right,
of why they are separate groups. Why are they split off? And we, the last episode you joined me, I was actually trying to elucidate a little bit on why are there all these different groups? Why were they really disagreeing? And there were reasons. Sometimes they were disagreeing about how to fight the Vietnam War, you know?
Right.
Some groups just want to be more militant than others. And it's as simple as that. This is represented in, like, I'm rewatching a playthrough, again, another tangent, but of Detroit Becoming Human, where it's basically about a robot uprising, but you play as the androids.
And awesome. One
of the storylines is you are the android leader, and it's like, it's up to you. Your choices affect where the movement goes, which of course is a really basic line of how politics works. It's not how it happens.
Right.
It's all very ham-fisted, right? But it's still better than what's out there. And so, like, you can choose to be peaceful or riot. Shoot the cops, or, you know, just don't kill anyone, you know, or let them go. And
you're putting all these
situations.
One way is a lot more fun.
Yeah, because the people who choose the peaceful path, they're always racking themselves, like, I don't want to kill anybody. And that's just the basic liberal, neoliberal politics showing of like, let's not fight, you know,
we can't be violent because that makes us just as bad as the fascists. No, it doesn't.
Now, the game is written in a way where it plays into all of that. Public opinion only goes to your side if you're peaceful. And if you're violent or determined at all, it's like public opinion's down. And that doesn't really... You can still win, like, say, win by freeing all the androids. But it's now like you're starting a civil war by doing that.
Oh, okay.
And carving out territory. Or it makes it harder for the other storyline of the person, of the android with an android kid. For most of the game, you don't know it's an android kid. Spoilers. Ooh. But they're trying to cross into Canada. Like, it's like the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
But androids. Because they don't have android laws.
Have you ever heard of the book R.U.R.? Rossum's Universal Robots?
Well, I know of the... It's a play first.
Yeah.
It was a play first. And yes, that was the first instance of the word robot.
Yeah.
Robot means worker in Czech.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yes.
I listened to the book a couple weeks ago, and it was fascinating because it's really old. Like, it was written a long time ago.
1920s.
But it still is incredibly relevant to our society and technology.
Modern lit is modern lit. Like, the change, you can go back to the Renaissance. Basically, you could say use Shakespeare as like a dividing line if you want. Everything after Shakespeare, or after the Renaissance, creation of Puritan church and all that, English church, that's the dividing line of like, now you can understand everything after this point. If it's English, you can understand it. You can read it. Like, oh, this is the satire they do is like our satire. It hasn't changed an iota. The writing style, the creation of the novel, the creation of the scientific method. You know, we're still working. That is where our civilization begins, but it's where our phase of history, let's say.
Yeah.
Right? This modern phase, like, starts. I mean, you can subdivide it, of course, but it's all just categorizing at that point. But as far as the material change of, like, you can read a piece of lit from 1650, and it reads or translates just as well, if it's French, as something today or in the 20th century. But go a century before that, 1550, 1450, it's practically gibberish.
Yeah.
Or it's like Shakespeare. And it's like, well, I can get some of these words and whatever we're kind of saying, but it's still like thous, thots, you know, what is...
Well, it's I gotta say, learning German, like, I've been learning German for the past month, and it's made some of the older forms of English, like, I can understand a lot more of it than before I was learning German, because English is a Germanic language.
Yeah.
And old, like...
With the Renaissance, it was Romanized or Latinized more. It took on more... And guess what happened in the intervening years in England?
They were
invaded by the French.
Of course.
So a lot more French words were then put
in.
Who
would have thought that that's what happens when you're...
when your ruling class becomes a different nationality.
Exactly.
Okay, so back to... So one of the, this is just one thread at the leftist unity discussion. New page, they're starting to collect admins of various tendencies. That means one will be an anarchist, one will be a Leninist, one will be, you know, whatever.
Trotskyist.
Something else. Yeah, something else. And we'll all agree, hopefully, to not make any jokes about the other, even though one of the posts was this joke where we've all been arrested as protesters.
Oh, I love this one.
And let's see if I can remember. I don't have it in front of me, but I can remember it. We're at the, you know, it's like, oh, yes, we're asked to define anarchism, you know, because anarchism, as Joe Biden said, will be a crime.
And then
it's like, well, I know what anarchism is. It's 1,000 times cooler than communism. And then
order, order.
As my communist co-defendants try to attack me, must be held back by the bailiffs.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I think I might have, no, I try to avoid leftist infighting on my page.
You do seem to do a good job, even though there's some people that want to
There's definitely like, people that want it.
But why? Like, what are you getting? It's just like, you're just trying to have fun, but it's just like, there's better ways of having fun. We joke about people to our right, you know? And
I actually got a message the other day that I was...
It becomes like, say, like the, if you were saying ML, like the anarchists, they're not really left, you know, and that's where it starts.
Right.
You're almost dehumanizing in a way by saying they're not in our in-group. They're liberals. I'm defining them as liberal.
But I had someone message my
page. Because they have individualistic thinking.
And they were like, hey, I just wanted to thank you for being one of the better leftist pages out there and not bashing on tankies all the time. And I respond, hey. Tankies are comrades, and I think it's a waste of time for us to be fighting amongst ourselves and not, you know, fighting capital.
There's all these pages, and they're basically just as bad as B-Board or any of those other, like, you know, the where the right-wingers spawn from themselves. It's just like, you're just creating toxicity and training ourselves to be mean-spirited jerks. So here's a thread. So I'm not going to go over too deep into what the SWRF position is. I kind of touched on it, that, you know, you have leftists that are anti-sex work for these moralistic reasons, that the baseline of it is, you know, all sex is exploitative if you're a woman, because you're not free to actually consent. So in the same way that we talk about work and wage slavery, that as long as you have to pay bills, rent property, or basically take out a mortgage to own property yourself, unless you're inheriting it, you have to work 20 years to own anything.
Exactly.
And if that work is something that's contracted, you're essentially an indentured servant of a type.
Wage labor.
But we don't have such contracts. But let's say, you know, even if you say you're contracted, but let's say if you're not, then it's informal. And you're just going from one mini contract for as a gig worker to another to pay the bill, scraping by, and you're not even accruing any actual wealth.
No.
And
you're generating wealth for your boss.
Yes, many more times. And that's labor theory of value, that whatever you're making as an employee must be less than the value you're making for the business. Otherwise, there wouldn't be profit. They wouldn't break even.
Right.
But they can't break even because of interest and the loans they're paying. So it's all just trickle up, even when you have Keynesianism, where you have government pumping money in. They're pumping money so that it's stable enough so everyone can work to pay the rents.
Trickle down
and
economics.
And that's the stimulus we're getting right now, the ability to just give people money to pay their rent so that landlords can then pay the banks.
Right.
So it's all just going to the banks eventually.
Exactly.
Anyway. So just freeze rents and liquidate the banks, bail out the banks, if that's, you know, what – more steps. It's just making it more complicated. But you got to have the appearance that everything is, can still work the way it works because everyone, you know, believes in it, or enough people do, and people can't imagine the alternative to right. to freezing rent, which Ithaca has done, and capitalism is actually starting to unravel. So that's a story we'll do in a future episode. Ooh. I don't know how it's unraveling, but I'm sure the bonds are breaking in a way. So this is just a thread that kind of touches on all the arguments for an ethical sex work, the visioning of a consensual ethical sex service industry that's cooperative, worker-owned, and all the things that we like, and why to ethically and morally justify it as well. So this is from, let's see, Alex Davis is the poster. The OP. I mean, he's one of the mods. I'm going to try to do my best not to express my personal views on this discussion topic until the comments. Sex work is sex work in leftist utopias. So we're talking about the best possible worlds in our visioning so we can organize to get there. To make some crystal clear distinctions that I hope everyone who made it to the page can agree upon. Pedophilia in any form is abhorrent. Sex slavery in any form, from pimps to Asians adopted young, are abhorrent. Sex work as it exists as a black market activity in capitalism is unsafe for workers and customers riddled with ethical failures. All of these statements are basically things that have to be gotten out of the way to have the discussion. Because otherwise, if you just say sex work, ethical, how could it be ethical? Or, you know, let's brainstorm how it can be ethical. You'll have people going through all of these points first. And then you basically just have the whole discussion just trying to define the terms or what's bad now instead of what could be good later, which is why I really like this post. My questions to you, however, is can sex work exist in an empowering way in a leftist utopia, whether authoritarian or anarchistic? Is sex work a valid contribution to the community? Does the lack of a capitalist market exchange increase or decrease the ethical nature of sex work? In a leftist utopia, a farmer couldn't refuse to give produce to a comrade citizen. How would we reconcile that with the necessity for sexual autonomy? Can we? Acknowledging that sex work now represents a range of services, from OnlyFans, that's an app, sex lines to actual escort services, do you draw a line somewhere? I know this issue is important to a lot of people and may present a divisiveness. Please be civil, stick to theory, avoid ad hominem, other fallacies. Remember, we're all comrades. There's 100 comments now. So first one is, you know, I'm just going to read a plethora of these. Sex work is work. I'm certain that there will be far fewer sex workers when you remove the coercive forces, but I think that there will be people willing to do it, especially if we remove the stigma around it. In fact, you can see that willingness in amateur porn. I hard agree. I think sex workers need workplace rights, safety measures, respect. Making it legal would weed out a lot of perversion. There will always be people looking to be bad actors, and we'll always deal with them appropriately. I changed the language there. I'm ace, so take my perspective with whatever caveat you need. Ace refers to asexual, meaning they don't feel sexual feelings. Does mean they can still enjoy the content or understand it, but simply it's like, I compare it to like someone else picking your nose. Not very pleasant.
Now, I like to do that for myself.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what else they wrote, though. All those points above pretty much sum it up. Human sexuality is a part of human culture and society. Some term that works. So to dismiss it, to have any potential applications outright, is unhelpful. So this is what rad femmes do. I had this argument with an older radical activist at they were in the labor committee. And I had an argument with her. I don't know how it started or how it came up, but I basically was like pointing out that I see all of this voluntarily made pornographic art that I consume.
Yeah.
But it's all community. It's all done voluntarily. It's not for pay. It's not a marketplace. It's community. And like you're telling me that's exploitative. Where's the exploitation happening? Maybe it's perpetuating. They would say perpetuating your masochistic or, what do you call it? Your patriarchal attitudes, let's say. It's like, yeah, but a lot of it is made by women or queer or, you know, completely diverse set of kind of people figuring out their own sexuality. So anyway, Let's see. I essentially believe, what I hope everyone believes, that the elimination of the alienation of labor, new term for you, so that all work can be done as a form of expression and growth, not as coercion for need, is kept to at least eliminating the majority of abuse. That includes child trafficking, misogyny, that's the word, queerphobia, and other aspects that sneak in that may require more than just some capitalist analysis of that's bad. The erotic arts are pretty important to human culture, society, whatever, but I find how capital can use it in the same way they are use advertising to isolate and make one feel empty or even perpetuating harmful ideas. This must be crushed. So, in some, sex work is work. Sex workers are some of the most vulnerable comrades. If one enjoys sex work and does it consensually, all power to him. Let's make sure that it is all consensual and safe. A lot of good points there. Someone, Ash Huntington, adds, the farmer crop point is interesting. I don't think it could be at all applicable to a leftist utopia regarding sex work. In such a utopia, I feel like bodily autonomy would preempt any sort of requirement to provide it or engage in it. Response, I agree that any situation that required a sex worker to have sex with anyone is abhorrent. So is there a world where they can practice this in a leftist way and maintain that right to deny such service? Or do you feel that the only solution is to keep it outlawed? If so, and this would be outlawing the exchange,
right?
Which is where like the end, the idealistic communist end goal is
of no currency.
No currency. We're not exchanging anymore. We just have the stuff around because it's made and it's distributed based on, you know, a form you fill out.
Right. Mutual aid.
I'm going to use this much toilet paper, or I use this much toilet paper. So you get that much toilet paper.
Right.
And it's like, if you need more, there's a cushion. That's what surplus is for. Okay, you can get two extra. It's okay. This is how any kind of management of anywhere works, right? You know, you order based on what you did last year, and you need a little bit more, a little bit less based on other conditions.
Well, I found a good comment on the same thread about that, and it was someone talking about how in the Netherlands, disabled people actually get a yearly allocation to pay for a sex worker, reasoning being that extreme forms of disability prevents one from pursuing a normal sex life, and that in the case of motor disabilities might even prevent them from pleasuring themselves. What do you think about this specific application of sex work? I think that I don't really have any issues with it.
Let's see. Response from Alex Davis. I think we strive for a society that doesn't require money, but I think the disabled case, as others have mentioned, is a very good one for why sex service may be a valid community contribution in a communal society. And I commented that sex service, that's good phrasing.
That is good phrasing.
Because if we're always phrasing it as work.
Right.
Work is, and then I have a book by this name, Abolish Work. And there's a particular kind of mindset of like, work is negative. Work is grinding. When we're developing our, let's say, what was it? Growth and develop and expression, that we do labor to do that instead. That it's like work is then no more. We're doing things because we want to.
Right.
You want to build things because you want to, you build things. And then you're in the labor pool for building things, you know? And of course, there's, it's not a matter of just incentives, but just part of the distribution of, like, say, the Paracon participatory economy.
Right.
Is this many people need builders. And, you know, but it's not, we need that many builders so that this many people must be builders. But then this many people say they want to be builders, and then it becomes a negotiation between those two groups of, okay, we can't provide that many builders because if we did, we'd be coercing labor. We're now going to set limits to growth, consumption, and whatever gross consumption habits people have. This is why when I have responded to, like, you know, we called a 6% dip in the GDP a depression. What do we call a 33% dip in GDP? I called it ecological balance.
Yeah, that's a good way
of putting it. What were you going to call it?
Not great.
Ah. Well, considering GDP, and this is something that even liberals have recognized, that GDP is a terrible indicator for economic well-being.
Right.
Why does anyone care? We should be looking at other indicators.
I'd like for us to look at happiness.
Home ownership, you know?
Yeah.
We use that, and that's never always good. Like in cities, it's always half.
Or worker ownership of the economy.
That's growing slowly, but depending on how you define it, apparently a quarter of the economy is worker owned, but that's because you're including all these corporations that have stock options.
Yeah.
Because the workers are benefiting from the value they generate more. We aren't utopian exactly. There is no end goal, only means. But that aside, a few points. First, why is sex so important? As another person pointed out, part of this is from capitalism. A sexual relationship is the only situation where most people get to experience communism, of sharing everything and doing things for each other without any payment or exchange. And so we balk at the idea of treating sex on the same level as normal work, because it is our one refuge. However, this is really an illusion. The only reason sex is so sacred is we know in our hearts that plenty of relationships are not equal, that for many, this is not a choice, even an economic necessity. For example, breaking up could mean homelessness. So I think we try very hard to avoid thinking about sex and work in the same sentence, to protect our illusions, our sense of self-righteousness, maybe. Even though the ways we want to liberate work for equality, freedom, and consent all match up very clearly with the kind of sex that we imagine as well. Second, we want to abolish these exchanges. So the essential idea of sex work at the moment, which is asymmetrical, mutual benefit, one person gets the cash, the other gets the experience, couldn't exist as such. That leaves certain questions. What does someone who is unable to find a person to have sex they want do in a free society? Might people still spend time fulfilling these people's desires, and that might be accepted as work in the same way as planting crops and making things? How does that even operate? Like that pleasure planet in Star Trek. I think it's an open question. Either way, no work of any kind shouldn't be forced, whether that's on an assembly line or in the bedroom. Simpler would talk about porn. 100%, I think that will continue. On the other hand, that we really want is to abolish the boundary between, and this is from a lot of different books, the boundary between work and play. In a way, all sex is work, after all. It's possible for a marriage to take the form of worker and owner where sex is one of the duties. People used to make the argument, in the past, that marriage is a type of prostitution for that reason, especially in Victorian era. I don't know how this will play out. It could be that all of sex as we know it disappears and something very different emerges. I don't know what, but it will be fun finding out. Sex, as gender, is a social construct of sites. What if sex, you don't orgasm? Is it sex if there is no penetration? Is it sex if you don't touch the genitals? Bearing in mind people can orgasm from other types of touch, even hypnosis. We could end up with
A hypnotist I'd like to meet.
We'll talk later. We could end up with totally different categories of how we could see pleasure. Now, I had a comment that using the standard word instead of sex, intimacy.
Okay.
There's a book that I actually have on my shelf, which is more about relationship communication and self-meditation. And it's called How to Be Intimate.
Hmm.
Intimacy is probably the more broader and more value-neutral term.
Yeah.
Rather, what it does value is care, understanding, and closeness. That it doesn't matter how you're being intimate. You know, pleasure is pleasure, or warmth and happiness results in various ways. And it comes in many forms. Because I've been intimate a few times, but I actually have not had any sex.
Oh.
By the definitions of insertion and, being aggressive.
Okay.
Let's say. This person brings up a practical concern. The first roadblock is legalization, but I think generally speaking, sex work is skilled labor that should be more appropriately be understood as sex therapy and additional services. I think that the role of the courtesan, mistress, in the Nouvelle Feminist framework could provide legitimacy, agency, and a stabilizing power on our society. In that, I think sex work should be a 4-year degree with training in mental health, safety, hygiene, self-defense, and other social sciences.
Huh.
Now, that's where I run into issues without further education myself. Is gatekeeping a profession in where the key product is already inherently owned and denying ownership in any capacity coercive? Now, that's a broader range. That means that calls into question any type of college degree to do anything. Now, I have an article in the wings. We'll do an architecture-based show. I just need enough material to fill in at least an hour. I could be close now. So let's move on. There's two more. There's some shorter things. Mostly trans. Can I get a trans rights?
Trans rights.
Trans rights. So let's. But actually, we probably there's plenty of other podcasts and whatever to talk about transness and trans rights and all the mistakes that transphobes make accidentally or intentionally. We're gonna discuss kind of the non-binary, the people who do not fit in these binary categories that are created even when people are trying to figure out transness of like, well, male, female, what are they or what degree? And basically you stop the hair splitting and the exclusionary impulses by just accepting everyone for where they are.
Yeah.
You can categorize people a thousand ways, like ice cream, like plants and animals. It's not saying that one is inherently better than the other. In fact, that's the whole point of doing that. As soon as you set up binaries or try to categorize people as one thing or another, or like just keep the number small so I can get it. Right. It's like, no, you're not going to get it because you only want it to be two categories.
Yeah.
There's not two types of fish and non-fish.
Well, the best thing to ask those people helpful. Is to be like, hey, so what's your opinion on hermaphrodites? What gender are they? Because if you can get people to like understand that there are some people who don't fit into or don't fit neatly into one of the two categories, you have to then create more categories. You don't really have another option. And
adjectives.
Yeah.
It's not a scientific, you know, study thing, even if people cared about that, which they don't.
Right.
They're not cracking open actual biology textbooks when they're talking about this stuff. They're just saying it's biology, which is what all the TERFs do. They speak like it's the science that there's only two sexes and genders and and that's their problem because they're actually being really unrealistic and biased, all that, and they can't admit it. And but that will come later. So right now, let's go for the Hearts and Rainbows article called "Gender is Over, Canceled."
All right,
this is from a teen who's written a book of sorts, or published a book.
Good for them.
Raising My Rainbow, Adventures in Raising a Fabulous Gender Creative Son. Let me use gender creative. Dad probably wants to know where his car is. I could have ignored that. I forgot. Like, do I sell the car? Anyway.
Yeah.
I did take it this morning, but I filled the gas. Because that's what you do. You leave things better than you left it. That's like one of those mottos that you can probably take anywhere and apply everything.
Yeah.
Whether it be a chat room, leave it better than you left it. Yeah. People do not do that. They're like, no, I'm going to throw trash everywhere. And by calling other people trash. That's what you're doing. You're littering mentally. Okay. So this is written from his point of view, from someone who's gender nonconforming.
Okay.
So this is just the kind of primmy point of view baseline, and it's nice. My name is CJ. I'm 13 years old, and I'm a member of the LGBTQ community. My gender identity is male. My expression is female. That means I'm awesome. Just kidding. It means that I was identified male at birth, and I like that. I prefer these pronouns, but the way I dress and the things I like are considered feminine, whatever that means. Another way to describe me is gender nonconforming, or gender creative, to be positive. Because nonconforming can, you know, has negative connotations. For as long as I can remember, I like all the stuff in the pink aisles. I've always known I'm different, and I've always known that I'm not a typical boy. And I've never really cared that I'm different. There's no part of me, not even a single part, that wants to be a typical boy. The thought of having to play baseball where boys' clothes makes me cringe with sadness. It makes me feel like I'm forced to do something I don't want to. Kids shouldn't be forced to do something by someone who they aren't. Kids should be able to be themselves. You can tell this is a preteen because the sentences are short.
Yeah, just
so this is not written by the parents. Yes. Let's see. When people call me a girl or misgender me, I really don't care. To me, gender is over. Gender is so last year. But when someone tells you that they are preferred pronouns, their preferred pronouns, you should use them. Just like when they tell you their name and you use it. When I was little, like 5 or 6 years old, I wanted to be a girl. I never felt like I was a girl or like I was supposed to be a girl. That means that I'm not transgender. I don't feel like I'm in the wrong body. I feel like I'm in the right body, mine. I know transgender people who have transitioned. I'm happy for the people who do, and it means that they are being their authentic self. But transitioning isn't for me. My advice for younger kids like me is that it's going to be okay. Be yourself. People will learn to like you the way you are. You aren't weird. You're different. And being different is awesome. Everything is awesome. Come on, jump me.
Oh, great. Now that's stuck in my head.
Oh, that all took. All right. Live stream's over, but we're starting the show, so.
Yeah.
Let's see. I hate it when people say that my parents are forcing me to be this way, the way I am. It's seriously so stupid. How could my parents be forcing me to do these things that I truly actually want to do? It makes no sense. I'm being me 100%, and at this point, I don't care who sees me being me. I haven't always felt this way, felt that way. I've been bullied badly, but I've always come out stronger. Bullies are not going to stop me from being me. That's why usually a lot of trans women get killed, because they're not going to stop. But then it becomes the transphobe's duty to end that. And if you have to end or fix somebody by killing them, this is not something to justify. And apparently society at large still seems okay with it. All the rainbow flags and we stand for trans, it doesn't mean anything unless there's some concerted effort to reduce the murder. And that means changing the laws, which actually allow for the panic defense, which allows men to get away with murdering trans women. So that's kind of why it's still not seen as a bad thing in the eyes of the law. So unless the law has changed, your symbolism is not really helping. It's not doing it.
It's just rainbow capitalism.
Yes, it's advertising. And I think we should be limiting advertising. So we, you know, phase it out. Some of my favorite things, doing a makeup, hanging out with friends, watching Queer Eye, blah, blah. I also want to be an advocate for my communities, non-binary included. My mom says that if you're in a position to help, you should. And that's what I do. I helped, and this is the activism part, I helped make my elementary school the first school in the district to adopt a dress code that wasn't gender specific.
Oh, good.
1 year later, the dress code was used as a model for every other gender, elementary school in the district. That's 26 in all. Through meetings and email campaigns, I got my school district to stop the sex and gender segregation in PE classes and to stop having special event dress codes that were illegal because they did discriminate against the gender nonconforming. If I can see a way to make life better and easier for the gender creatives, I always try to do it. Being kind and sticking up for others, not being a jerk, that's what life is all about. That's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah.
So in that vein, let's advance the age clock a little bit and go to Brooklyn, where there are non-binary political candidates suing the Brooklyn Dems over gender designations. This is from the Brooklyn paper, local, filed by Kevin Duggan. Derek Gaskill, who identifies as transmasculine, is one of 6 plaintiffs suing the Brooklyn Democratic Party. Now, this is not really leftist politics, but these are probably, you could assume, maybe social democrat, dem socialists, who are the up-and-coming, you know, crop, trying to take over the party.
Yeah.
And, of course, I have negative feelings about that, but all power to them. They are doing what they think is practical.
They'd probably have an easier job taking over the Green Party, but that's not neither here nor there.
The Greens in Brooklyn, or like say the DSA in Brooklyn, which is super power, like they're super big.
Oh yeah,
they could be running their own lines at this point. Now there is like Jabari, I think, who is now in the state senate or assembly. He first ran on the Green and created an independent socialist line.
Awesome,
and he got like a third of the vote, and I think he had basically switched tacks and ran in the Democratic primary this time and won.
Yeah.
So there's that. And that's kind of a point in the column of the let's just use the Democratic line because these are the voters that, you know,
right.
go out and vote regularly. And but it's like, then you're not really building up that base, it takes more than a few elections to do that. With Howie, it's 24, you know, it's still counting.
Yeah.
And this apparently makes him a loser. I think it makes him a winner in that he could do something for 30 years and still be doing it well to some point. A group of non-binary political candidates have sued the Brooklyn Democratic Party and the city's Board of Elections together because their ballot petitions only allowed for male or female gender designations, demanding the party drop these gender parity rules originally intended to bring more women into the political sphere. Now, I chose this story because it probably exemplifies an example of what TERFs refer to when they say that transness or the gender nonconforming hurt women's rights. Ugh. Because the only thing that their existence challenges the gender or sexual parity rules of the affirmative action regime from the 70s, right? So you have this holdover policy that has either completely served its purpose or is continuing to serve a purpose, but not as well as it could have because black and brown faces in high places isn't justice. It's justice for some because it's allowing some more people get a fair opportunity at education / career. But it's not justice for a community or collectively.
Yeah, freedom isn't having more minorities as abusers.
Right. This is where structural and class analysis is kind of...
Right.
When it was dumped for the affirmative action, you know, policy. And this is kind of partly challenging that with identity. By saying, we're all in this together, and you're still separating things in male and female. Black and white. The six Brooklynites, running for county committee membership of the party, the lowest rung of elected office, alleged that the party... So these would be committee seats within the Democratic Party?
Yeah.
Which is kind of step one in you stack that or get a majority, and then you can start rewriting rules to make, say, the Brooklyn Dems social Democrats
right.
in general and change the game a little bit. But then you've got the Metropolitan Area Party and then the State Party basically bearing down on you as soon as you do that.
Yeah.
But, of course, as soon as the Greens get a little bit of momentum, then they change the rules on us. So... full revolution or bust, I guess. One plaintiff said he was disappointed by the lack of recognition for non-binary identities in the political process. For me, as a trans person trying to engage with local politics, it is disheartening that there are only two options at county level. You have to declare that you're male or female, who identifies as transmasculine. Gaskill and his fellow plaintiffs, who are vying for representation in sections of Williamsburg, Brunswick, and Bed-Stuy, all filled out petitions in March with signatures from local voters. However, they left the gender field blank because the sheets only had those two options. They identify across the spectrum of gender nonconforming identities, including non-binary, gender fluid, gender queer, transgender. According to lawsuit, which was organized by the reform-oriented club New Kings Democrats, they allege that Board of Elections then filled out gender designation forms without their consent, signing them false genders based off their names.
Ooh.
The spokes were, because you just had to fill a box, apparently. Box had to be filled, right? Have to put people in boxes. Spokesperson for the agency declined to comment on pending litigation. So, they're still figuring out what they're going to do. Plains argue that the Kings County, you got to change those forms. It's so much work, so much money to do that for the next cycle. While these rules were originally intended to encourage more women to join the historically male-dominated political sphere, they further the exclusion of everyone else. Though it doesn't fit in those binaries. Oh, yeah, because there's a rule that, for example, each assembly district in the party has to be represented by one male and one female. Now, the Green Party actually has a similar rule, and we're always kind of haggling over what that means. Women, men, like, what's with trans? Well, so we're basically kind of going with what is your gender expression and the truism that trans women are women. So we count trans women in the... women, you know, one woman, one man spot. So that solves that problem with the trans, with the non-conforming. that's a different issue that we haven't solved or discussed how to solve yet. Because it's when a nonconforming person wants to be basically a state chair of the Green Party or right. something, that's then, when we'll have to like discuss yep. what, you know, then either we discuss changing the rule somehow
or not
and just saying they're not one or the other, they're both, so they can count as the male or the female.
Or say they can pick either one they want to consider themselves as, or make a.
But that's not as similar. Then that's kind of close, though, to the here's two boxes you can just check.
Yeah, that's yeah.
And that's not fair.
No.
So something else. No, in this case, it's just a matter of registration, and that means you are in fact dropping these parity rules, and that's where it's like this hurts women. This hurts now it doesn't guarantee a woman's spot. And as far as like say in Rojava, where they also have that same rule of councils need to be balanced based on sex/gender. They're separate things, but you know, let's say we just go with sex. The Brooklyn Party recently eliminated gender parity rules at leadership when top brass elected Assemblywoman Bri Roche as the new party boss to succeed Frank Sedero, making her the first woman to hold that position. The rule stated that the party's executive committee chair, technical title, and vice chair also needed to be different genders. So they used gender, not sex. But okay. The committee struck down that rule, because how you present is probably more important than what your genitals are. But the committee struck. But here's where the radical feminists step in and say, like, well, it's essential to being a woman that you make babies, or you are able to make babies, and that's what unites sisterhood. And if you can't make babies, then. But then you counter with, right. What about the infertile women? What about people? You express yourself as a woman, you then are exposed and get a brunt of patriarchal abuse. So you're saying they don't have those women experiences? Now who's not being material?
And what about women who've already gone through menopause?
It doesn't count. They were able to make babies before. You know, that's what they say. Or they just skip all that. And some are very honest and actually just say trans people ick them out and it's unnatural. And they're just saying what they are. And that's unmaterialistic.
At least they're saying the quiet part out loud.
There's different levels of it.
Yeah.
Let's see. We don't comment on lawsuits, but we are aware of it. And it raises an important question. So as the communications director in an email, the same issue has come up in the Democratic State Committee, which is studying it, and we are monitoring that. Let's see. The plaintiffs argue that the party should not only drop these gender parity rules at the highest level, but also at county committee membership. Its broadest base of elected members at 1,881 female to 1,550 male members. Female majority. The plaintiffs argue that the party should... King's Democratic Committee would vote to rescind the sex parity rule as it applies to top leadership positions while maintaining a similarly inequitable rule for the lowest, broadest, and most democratic level public engagement, membership, reflects arbitrary and capricious standards of rulemaking. You know, so above, so below. These disproportionately impact the non-binary, the intersex, the transgender, and other community members alike at the ground floor. So I'll have to stop there for the hour, but we'll be back in the next hour.
All right.
Where we will continue this. Otherwise, this has been the Three Lefts podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter as well. It was where sometimes I post episodes. But pretty much you want to go to threelefts.news, threelefts.news for the archive and any new posting of episodes. You can also find this podcast in any podcast app that you may have, or on most of them, including Spotify and Stitcher and all the others. iTunes, of course. And yeah, so thank you very much, and we'll see you on the other side of the hour.
See you later.
Malcolm X.
So anyway, let's move forward. Welcome. This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Josh Walsh in the studio.
Michael Walsh.
Oh, Michael.
Yeah, don't worry.
I have a friend named Josh, and he just contributed to the title, at least, to an article exposing the privatization of homeless shelters in New York City.
Huh, interesting.
It's been slowly done through, basically bankrolled by Bloomberg.
Of course.
Among other sources.
Of course it has.
And basically, you basically have feudalism working where you have people who are out of prison, recovering alcoholics like my friend. He's younger, and because he stopped working and went into rehab, he thus becomes homeless.
Hi, I'm Mike Bloomberg. Work for me or I'll throw you on the street.
So one of his friends is making bank.
Yeah.
And his house is provided by the nonprofit. And so basically you have all of these, it's a workfare program where you get room and board for working, what is it, 30 hours a week, basically cleaning the streets for bids. So the bids pay a minimum wage to them as a fee to the nonprofit. The nonprofit then takes half of the fee, gives it to the worker, but then also deducts rent. So it then becomes less than minimum wage.
Yeah.
And it's like a thousand of men doing this. Yeah. And so they're forming up a lawsuit for that. Let's wrap up. So I want to tell the story and of TERFs. And so, you know, we're talking about trans issues and non-binary folks and the wailings of rad femmes who... They're usually older, yes, and Rowling is the prototypical celebrity version of this.
Yeah.
I'm gonna digress for a moment because I want to hit on this, and I don't think there's going to be another good context for it, about Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam worldview.
Okay.
Where you have a C-list celebrity like Nick Cannon. He has apologize for anti-Semitic comments, but what... grinds my gears is that he was not making off-the-cuff comments. He was expressing the worldview that him and a whole swath of black community activists or whatever hold.
Didn't he just quote Hitler? Isn't
he
that
was
what
quoting Louis Farrakhan, but Louis Farrakhan is a trash fire.
Ah.
And I don't know if it's proven, but Farrakhan may be rumored to be behind killing Malcolm X. Because they were rivals in the Nation of Islam at the time. And you see, Malcolm X was moving towards the direction of, we can all get along, I'm starting to open my eyes on some things, we can build socialism together with white people, kind of thing. And moving towards MLK, MLK was moving towards him, on the, we have to get more militant, and so on.
Yeah.
And because things were changing and developing. And Malcolm X was starting to, you know, and this was against the worldview of Farrakhan, which was like, no, black separatism, only black, and not anti-capitalist, not socialist.
Hmm.
Farrakhan is not a socialist. He's kind of, everyone who follows him is like a black capitalist, you know. We should just buy from our own, develop our own economy, and that's how we'll have our own capitalism. And that's how we'll be independent of the white man.
Yeah.
And then, and not just the white man, but the Jewish bankers. And that, so the, it's not just anti-Semitic mistakes, it's the worldview. And that's where, like, it's kind of positive that Nick Cannon, having to apologize and backtrack, has now caused him, and I'm assuming what's happening is he has to then reevaluate his belief system.
Yeah.
As everyone who follows Louis Farrakhan needs to do. I am ranting at black people. It's the only time I'll do it, I swear. Because I see it in my neighborhood. Some of the activists, the ACT militant, they talk, don't know that well because they'll share Louis Farrakhan stuff. They'll share anti-Semitic stuff. And I just want to call them out, but I know they're not going to listen because it's part cult. And you can see, pulling Nick Cannon out of the cult, it's made him suicidal. Having to apologize, reevaluate his worldview, he's like, I don't know what's up or down anymore. Because I've had to say... no, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I believe all this stuff about Jewish bankers or how, like, this cabal keeps the black man down, right? It's not capitalism. It's white supremacy and capitalism together, because there's no class analysis. And the class analysis is identity based. The classes are black and white, and that's it. And Jews became white, and thus Jewish bankers.
Well, anti-Semitism, I saw, who was it? Philosophy Tube did a fantastic piece on anti-Semitism and talked how it's the poor man's socialism, and how it's the idea that, yes, there is a group of people who have all of the money and are controlling the world, and it's the Jews. I'm a Jew, and I don't have
money,
and I don't control the world. There are a group of people who are controlling the world and have all the money. They're not all Jewish.
I did an episode on this earlier. It was like episode 32
or something.
Okay. It was called Jewish History for the Perplexed, and I spend basically half an hour basically discussing the difference between, like, in the modern era, Jewish society split in half.
Yeah.
Because you then had Jews that got rich and Jews that stayed working class.
Yep.
And of course, in the 20th century, many Jews professionalized, as many other people did. Italians and other immigrants that could pass for white or be accepted once they proved that they, too, were a genocidal people with Columbus Day and all that. And that's why kind of attacking Columbus is kind of a part of telling Italians, like, stop acting proud about being genocidal. We don't want anyone to be proud of this. Not if they're Anglo-Saxon, not if they're Italian. We want to, like, tell everyone to cut it out.
Yeah, don't be proud of your genocide.
So let's go back to another type of pseudo-deluded people who can be really good. So, like, you have people in the Green Party, older set or not, mostly older. They're good peace activists. You know, they've been community activists for 50 years or 30 years. They switched the Green Party with in 2000 when Nader ran. And they believe in the party more or less, but they're rad femmes. And they have these worldviews that they picked up when they first read Gloria Steinem and the other type of post-Marxian feminists of that era. What occurred earlier, I think it was earlier in the year, in the winter, so you had the half of the committee that runs the Georgia Green Party, they voted to endorse this document that TERF's put out. So it's like, this is the TERF big letter. That it's a declaration of, this is what's called, women's sex-based rights. So it's taking the position out that what makes a woman is their sex, and that means genitals, and that it's important to have that distinction, in fact necessary, as far as their view. Now, I read half of it. I stopped when I basically got to the third paragraph in a row that basically said, like, we're not anti-trans, but they need to disappear, or they're hurting the cause, or they need to be kept out of our spaces. We need the separation. We need the segregation. And I can't abide by calls for segregation, because it's for the best of everyone. That's what segregationists argue for. It's better for everyone if we just keep each other separate. No. We need to change our mindsets and our worldviews and our structures and the structures of power that create the inequalities.
Right.
Because segregation only reinforces them. Just as having women-only trains, it doesn't stop the rapists. It doesn't change the culture to have less rapists or rape culture mindset. It encourages it, in fact. It says it's okay, that it's natural, that it's a feature of society forever.
Yeah.
We're accommodating it. We're accommodating it. Enabling. So that's what that mindset does, in my view, and that's why it's harmful. So GA Greens added a plank that mirrors, and they changed a plank of their state platform that mirrored the West Virginia bathroom bill, you know, keeping trans people out of bathrooms. Yeah. Let's see, the case is all independent identity politics, which is that the case for the TERF case is that, you know, in the world of identity politics, that's put at risk if sex and gender are in fact lumped together. Let's see. So did these old guard rad femmes block or advocate against various developments, i.e. sex work, trans rights, queer culture? This is a question I was asking myself in my notes. 4 years ago, we pushed out a lot of these green capitalists, liberal moderates, or at least their influence in the Green Party is diminishing. So they've kind of been striking back out to recoup some of that. But other toxic old guards still remain because they are committed to the party and they don't want to leave. So then it just becomes like, well, you're not going to force me out. You can't force me out just for being trans or sticking up for women's sex-based rights. I would also point out, if you want some background on the worldview and the arguments around it or against it, check out ContraPoint's gender critical video, because a lot of the TERFs call themselves gender critical. They're critical of this gender as a construct or that gender even exists. Only sex exists. And if, you know, your gender is your sex. And trying to, say, decouple them or lump them together even is a problem. So then it gets confusing. You know, is the problem lumping them together? Is it separating them and saying they're different things? There is a fear of sectarianism, which is why we don't want to, like, just stamp them out completely or ban them. But there have been calls to ban them. And thus, their counter is, like, we want conversation, not expulsion. And so then it became a kind of battle of sorts of how many caucuses in the Greens and other state parties can either side. The Lavender Caucus, which represents trans members, and their counterparts in Georgia Green Party and some of their supporters around. And I listened to some of their conversations. Quite a trash file, in my opinion. But hey, I'm just a young, stupid, patriarchal male. That's their argument against me. Yeah. Whenever I try to just ask them about, well, I just represent myself or represent the, you know, the people who are bashing them, but nicer, try to be nice. And they'll still just kind of come down to, oh, you, honey, you just don't know better. I'm like, I'm giving you just as much information as you're giving me. And all you're giving me are people spouting their opinion with basing it on nothing. You know, they're not basing it on anything. Except we got to keep things separate for our own good. Why? Because trans women are not women. You know, they're men who are dressing up and they want to rape me. And you sound like a conservative, you know, pearl clutcher. And then, so, but they're a good peace activist. They're just as anti-war. Some of them are even, they're not really socialists, but, you know, they communal economics, they're on board. But they're not eco-socialists. They wouldn't identify as that. Here's a breakdown of TERF points. Sex, gender are the same. This is what I got from, like, listening to, like, an hour-long interview or a conversation. Essentialism of real women, that the XX chromosome can only have the real experience of a woman. And they also keep things in the realm of legal jargon. That it's important to define what a woman is legally for these rights, the rights of women. Which, you know, in the legal sphere, it's important to know what a woman is. And so they're really hung up on defining a woman as specifically as possible, because as far as legally concerned, you have to be specific if you're going to protect, quote-unquote, women. If you make that nebulous, then it becomes open to interpretation. But I would see that as a positive. It creates more room for lawyers and our friendly attorneys to sue on our behalf and open things up even further. But they see that as a danger. And this is a defensive, you know, conservative kind of reactionary politics of older types, that they'll only see the negative consequences. And that's usually, and this is the case with a lot of what I call moderate Greens, where they're always kind of trying to tease and prevent the negative consequences. Whenever something is proposed, they're always about the negative consequences. So, like, there was a thing about the policy that's a real basic kind of low-stakes policy for police reform, which is to require the police to have insurance. And they're like, this is a poison. And then you had people voting against the national platform because they considered this a poison pill, because police are workers and they're not millionaires and they can't afford their own insurance. And if it's a matter of the city picking it up, though, that's going to bankrupt the city and not be defunding the police. Having the police to have their own insurance, they're not going to be able to afford that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, then, so only, you know, it's like saying, like, so you only want rich people to be cops. Like, well, we also don't want anyone to be cops. So,
yeah,
six and one half a dozen the other. But they don't agree with less cops or whatever, and that's where they're moderates.
Right.
They're liberals at the end of the day. They just don't like war, and they're environmentalists. Yeah, so that just dovetails, and I'll spend the next 10 minutes on left party sectarianism, just because this is the only time, like, this is what it links into.
Yeah.
Can you vamp for me?
So, I have been reading State and Revolution by Lenin lately. I consider myself to be mostly an anarchist or mostly a syndicalist, but I feel as though it's important to have other perspectives and to be exposed to other perspectives. And I think Lenin is a very important figure. He won the Russian Revolution. But I also don't agree with everything that he said. I feel like Lenin is maybe slightly overrated just because he did win the revolution. So he gets...
He's the head. He has the statues.
All of the credit.
He has the statues,
he's
right?
He's got the statues.
But there's just as many monuments of crowds of people, and that's kind of what's important. To have a leader with the crowd with them.
Oh, yeah.
There's a monument to MLK in Albany, and it's him, regular size, with a crowd behind him as a mural. But they're also engraved into the rock, the stone, too. So that's really cool. I did not like the MLK statue in D.C. because it's just him with his arms crossed, and it's a big statue. And I'm like, this has nothing to do with MLK. It's just him looking stern.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't him speaking. This isn't him as a leader of a crowd, of, you know, civil disobedience. It's just a statue of him. And that's the problem. It's just like, this is the old way of doing monuments.
Yeah.
When the mall has examples of modern art monuments that are really good. The Vietnam Memorial and a few others. The one to Eisenhower, which wasn't built, thank God, was designed by Gary. And it was, that was a mess.
Oh.
We'll get into that. But I did bring up the Twitter thread about the history of the Green Party, which kind of explains the sectarianism within our organization. This also exists in the DSA, which, you know, I've covered sort of in other times. But I haven't touched on the Greens because I don't consider it dirty laundry since my side is winning, more or less. So, but it kind of exists in all parties since, you know, in the Democratic Party on the national level, there's always this discussion of the left and the corporatists. Populism versus not. So this is from Pittsburgh Green Left. I accidentally found myself reading U.S. Green Party history late last night, and I didn't realize how deep the tension is between the more liberal Greens and socialist ones, going back to the founding of the party. No wonder some demonize Howie Hawkins, Green Party presidential candidate. It's a personal feud at this point. So this is coming off of the last episode I've posted, will be my kind of cut up of the Green Party National Convention. The second hour is a Q&A with Howie Hawkins and Angela. Then the first half is like intros with Hillary Kane. She's been the co-chair of like the convention in 2016 too, and the fact that her name was Hillary Kane with, you know, the ticket as it was.
Yeah.
I found that funny. So Howie was basically the leader of the left green socialist faction in the party going back to the 80s, arguing the Greens needed to be working class movement. While electoral politics is an element of that strategy, it shouldn't be the only or even major focus, he argued. So when Howie says he's a party co-founder, he's not wrong. He founded the left green network that was a precursor to the real national one, which became the Greens or the Green Party USA, which was basically the leftist faction. The liberal Greens basically thought Howie and the left were agitators, as they usually do in any context, and tried to have him banned from national Green Party meetings, which is partly why he and the socialist faction formed the Greens, which for a while was the dominant organization. The Greens were dues-based, and so many liberal Greens argued that the structure wasn't that fair to people who registered to vote Greens in their state but weren't members since they didn't pay dues. They argued for a party-based structure, no dues, and to run more candidates. Like the Dems and the Republicans. Let's be like the winners. Let's be like a major party. Let's do things like the capitalists. Mike?
Aye.
State parties were formed rapidly, and so the liberal Greens founded a separate association of state Green parties from the original Party USA, based on a structure that they wanted. All the new state parties quickly joined, and so what was called the ASGP became dominant. Eventually, the two factions, the more liberal one and the more socialist Greens, started unification talks, sensing that the split was harming growth, and Hawkins represented the Greens, the others, the ASGP. So, you actually had some left unity attempting to happen, except you were dealing with liberals, but it was based on environmentalism and anti-war politics. A deal was reached, but the first attempt failed to pass. A revision called the Boston Agreement was formed, which was called for structural changes, including forming a national identity caucuses, which exists today, along with the states, so it wasn't just state party-based, because state parties could be dominated by a few. Tyranny of the active is called. So the liberal members voted in favor and adopted the changes. A majority of GPUSA also supported, but not enough for two-thirds to be official. As a result, this is mostly because it wasn't due-based. Howie managed ended up migrating over anyway, as the GPUSA limped along as a shell of its former self. Even 5 years ago, there was still a website. But I was like, what the hell is this? And I was like, oh, you should ignore that. That's not really a real thing. Eventually, this closed up for good, and the Association of State Parties effectively merged the two movements. After Nader's run in 2000, the liberal group voted to rename itself the Green Party of the U.S. and filed to become the recognized national party with the FCC. That's the name and org that exists now. The more liberal Green element wanted this to be a party-based structure, which I think is where the party inherits some of its blemishes. It tried too hard to copy the capitalist party structure of the Dems. The social screens pushed for caucuses and more democratic structure, which really isn't still there yet. Because we don't really have national votes on things except for some leadership and the committee leaders.
Right.
But that only happens like once every 2 years or something. And it's not really based on the issues. You know, it's just like who's the better manager. And then it becomes a who's more active, who has more experience.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if this liberal has more experience and they can fundraise better. But you put them in the top committee spot, and then it's like, I think we should endorse the Dem this time.
Oof.
Some of them will, like, they do that. And that's what's in Rhode Island. They've chosen not to endorse Harry Hawkins.
What?
The Rhode Island Greens, they put it as, their leadership committee put it as, like, an open question to their membership, which I was very suspect of. And they're like, we don't want to hurt the chances of Biden beating Trump. So... And this is Rhode Island. It's not a big state with a lot of votes. And it's not like electoral powerful. It's not a swing state either.
No.
And it's like, what are you doing? We're trying to build alternatives here.
Like if it was Florida or like Pennsylvania, so they're not might understand.
They're not riding with... Well, the Florida Green Party is all the way with us. I mean, they're in the eco-socialist side. Because adversity breeds resilience, I guess.
Right.
And in Rhode Island, which is pretty much practically like a mob state, it's like go along to get along. And so they're not riding with Biden, but they're not endorsing anybody, which, you know, of course, they're on a moving train. So it's sad. But that's what exists in the party, as in any org. After 2000, some of these issues came to a head again as Nader thought of running again in 04. Many were on the run as a Green again and keep growing the movement, but many of the liberal faction were scared of the Bush election repeating, and they gave in and started believing and repeating the spoiler narrative.
Ugh.
So it really hurts when it's not just in outside with the Dems and the apparatchiks spreading their lies a million times so that it becomes the truth in the minds of so many people, so many progressives. They believe the spoiler narrative. And then it becomes like, well, we can't really do your thing until we have the instant runoff voting, the ranked ballot. Choice. And like, okay, how do you fight for that? You got to fight with the Dems? You think the Dems are going to implement it well? Or the pressure? Where's the leverage? You know, and it's from Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, where there's this theme where Jack Sparrow is always talking about like leverage. Where's the leverage? Yeah. It's like, yeah, you need leverage. You're not going to get anything if there's no leverage.
Right.
You got a gun in your face.
That's why I cannot wait to run next cycle because
I think it's
going to be a good time.
Let's see. Okay. Due to some frank undemocratic rules that existed at the time, but they don't anymore, regarding presidential delegates, the liberal faction basically staged a coup to get Cobb the nomination and shut out Nader. David Cobb is his name. Cobb promised the run on a safe state strategy, which meant refusing to seriously campaign in swing states. Hawkins and the leftist faction deeply objected to this, saying Greens need to run everywhere and challenge the system, but Cobb was nominated anyway. Cobb lost nearly all of Nader's votes, and down-ballot Greens did the worst in party history. Safe states was an utter failure. The party recruited Cynthia McKinney to run in 08. She used to be a Democratic congresswoman as well. Pretty radical. She was basically like the squad.
Oh, nice.
But she basically lost her... She was primaried out by the establishment. So she was recruited to run in 08, but the party still only barely registered at the polls. I still wasn't aware of them at the time. It started to turn around with Stein in 2012. Stein had a stronger platform, in particularly adopting the Green New Deal from the Hawkins campaign for his governor run in 2010. Stein also rejected safe states at this point. Though she was in the pro-Cobb camp back in the early 2000s. David Cobb has also come around on this as well, by the way. He was running Stein's campaign in 2016. No, not 2016. Dunley was doing 2012? That. Cobb, yeah, I guess so. Okay. Or maybe he was just the press secretary. Stein got the most votes since Nader in 2016, in part because of her willingness to go out and talk about the Green New Deal and other issues like student debt. Something the Green candidates are usually skittish about because they're divisive and they're radical and liberals don't like them. Because it's like, so you have these liberal Greens that want to attract liberals. Democrats, that they're never going to. And I'm like, yeah. And so it always seemed like self-defeating to do that. In many ways. So it's like, if we make ourselves liberal enough and get all the socialists out, you'll have other like disaffected Dems join us.
We've got to become more socialist so we can pull the socialists who are already in the Democratic Party.
It's the same strategy that the Democrats take up with the moderate Republicans.
Yeah.
So exactly. We're taking on the moderate, like we're trying to attract moderate and more liberal Dems who aren't corporatists. And it's like, no, they're comfortable where they are. Right. They voted Biden.
Exactly.
Hawkins is again arguing for a green movement based on working class organizing. He argues Green New Deal needs to be, and thus, you know, people can call him a class reductionist by just saying that, needs to be primarily about the working class and economic rights. Only then can we address climate properly. He also argues it must become dues-based membership again. Hawkins is again arguing, many of the same people that had opposed the socialist faction in Hawkins is still around in the party. So as Hawkins' campaign heats up, there's folks in the party that remember the old debates and bad blood and seem pretty determined to keep the socialist element out. But the thing is, the socialist Greens have always been there, and at one point, socialist Greens movement was the largest faction. And after the disastrous liberal era of the 2000s, the party almost disappeared and it is still recovering. The momentum is definitely on the side of the eco-socialist faction and Hawkins. Some are upset by that, which is probably why they have tried to make noise about Ventura, Jesse Ventura, and such.
Yep.
Try to take away momentum from Hawkins, but this has not worked. The Green Party will fulfill its destiny as an eco-socialist movement, however. I feel optimistic about this direction, and I hope the youth will come in and help us grow. This is because the Youth Caucus has actually changed its name to the Eco-Socialist Caucus.
Hell yeah,
A young eco-socialist. Just not hiding behind, like, yeah, the young are more left. And
yes,
we joined.
We
I joined... After finding out about Howie. Howie's the reason I'm a Green. In the same reason that he ran in 2010. That was the first Green I voted for. Because he articulated the issues well and clearly. And they were socialist. I didn't know they were really socialist. I wasn't reading into it that way. But I was interested in socialism at the time. And then a year or so later, I meet Peter Lavinia, co-chair of the party now. And he was running for state senate. And then he actually identified himself as a Marxist. So I'm like, oh. There actually are lefties in the Green Party. I thought it was just environmentalist Dems who, you know, were anti-war, and that wasn't enough for me because I wanted socialism. I wanted left-wing policy.
Well, I just came into the Green Party. I had my first or went
Welcome.
To the first meeting when Bernie dropped out. When Bernie ended, I was like, okay, where do I want to go now? Because I don't want to be a Democrat anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found Howie, and I was like, well, I guess this is the place to be.
It angers me, and I do have to put anger in, because you have all these, we call them, what's the word?
Progressive?
Well, no. Well, the progressives, but like these progressive independent media types. think Jimmy Dore.
Oh, yep.
Kyle Kalinske.
Crystal Ball?
Not Crystal Ball. She's a Demp through and through. But you have these, they bash the Dems all the time.
Yep.
They're always fence sitting, though. They never join any other org. They never promote any other org. Maybe this is their like mindset of like staying independent. Not joining an org, not propose, not that I'm independent, I'm neutral, I'll interview a little bit of everything. But I'll bash the Dems all the time.
Yeah.
And say we need a third party, but I'll never do third party politics.
Yep.
Except maybe have some Greens on like Keith Medji, which was one of our convention chairs. And as Jimmy Dore has done. But he did that because he was running in LA.
Yeah.
He won't interview Greens outside of LA. And, you know, interview Lisa Savage. Interview Howie. He hasn't done it. He interviewed Jesse Ventura.
Of course he did.
And I'm like, what the hell? And it was Jesse just saying like, oh, I'm looking for a pathway to the Green Party nomination. And I said, you know, if you give me that, then I'll run. Like, but they basically aren't providing that. So I'm not really running. Good impression, actually. I'm surprising myself.
Yeah. I like impressions. It's fun.
Let's finish this up. Second, the debates over Nader and the safe straight strategy in the 2000s was well documented in Hawkins' book, Independent Politics, which includes essays from both sides. Very interesting read. Third, Hawkins' new or more recent book, The Case for the Independent Left Party, is available as an ebook from his campaign website as well. This is about how, and also includes a history of early independent, and I've read excerpts of it basically from an article earlier in the year. Fourth, the Institute of Social Ecology has an essay about the early history of the Green Party from a more left-green perspective compared to the essay on the National Party website. And then some comments of like, oh, thank you for the summary. This was really great. So there's the end of that. So that wraps up my internal Green Party airing of grievances for Festivus. Last, the remaining time, I want to finish, since we did talk about the trans and nonconforming, I want to hit the relationship anarchism piece. Right. So let's see. I'll have to do a summary. Okay, so I have this article or blog post. Sorry. It's a very dense, jargon-heavy, impossible to read just once blog post called Not Relationship Anarchism, But Relationship Communism, written by a Zoe Bileski, moniker Commie Mommy, via Medium. And it's very dense. I had to read it three times to really get at what she's talking about. I finally was able to summarize it well.
Okay.
And there's a few paragraphs that actually can scan, meaning you can read it out loud and you don't like, what the hell am I saying? Because, you know, otherwise she basically writes like the Lenin talks like from the other episode. The revolution that, or Bakunin did. The revolutionary struggle is a revolution.
It's all this jargon. You're like, what am I saying?
Okay, so first, good description of relationship anarchism. What the hell is that? Well, maybe in mainstream media like Space Force, you have mentions and subplots of open marriages. This is where the doctrine of monogamy, of staying faithful, and this is what good marriage is, and this is what good healthy relationships where men and women own each other, and you have to know everything they're doing, and you can't share their bodies or social lives, and all these toxic, unhealthy things, and people cheat on each other, and this is immoral, morality, and of course it leads to fights and disarray, because it's like one or the other.
Right.
Either you're a slut, or you're chaste. To get beyond that, there's been some social experiments in free love, or an evolution of it, called relationship anarchism. So parts on the table. In what follows, I describe what I have come to understand as the ethics and conceptual concepts of this term, relationship anarchism, as it frequently concedes itself. So the people do it, this is how they do it. Known as RA, Paradigm for Ethical Consensual Relationships, and this also then dovetails with the sex work stuff. It's non-hierarchical, non-oppressive, non-monogamous. It refuses to value the value of heterosexual monogamy as a dominant relationship and seeks to develop alternatives. RA places its values. See, the problem with the writing style of this is that she uses too many words. She could drop half of the words she uses.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to paraphrase. RA places its values in consent, verbal, otherwise, explicit communication, and negotiating. Personal boundaries. At its best, it deploys powerful language, which is borrowed from feminist critiques of patriarchy, such as emotional labor, and its distribution of it. self-determination, and so on. RA does not distinguish hierarchy, does not create a hierarchy between friendships, romance, platonic stuff, or any other kind. It doesn't say one is more better, you know, more meaningful than another. Let's see. And so much as the distinctions that reflect a negotiated structure. Now, usually the pushback from this is that, like, when you have sex, the emotional connection is, like, you know,
right,
biologically wired. So it's like, it's going to be more meaningful when there's that involved. But then, of course, if you are not completely sexually minded, asexual,
right,
arrow like myself, you don't want these hierarchies because it basically says you're lesser because you're not as interested in those things. RA teaches that all relationships are unique, equally worthy of consideration and emotional presence. So it's just like, oh, we're just friends. I don't have to give you a shoulder to cry on. You should have a boyfriend for that, you know? You have to have a significant partner all the time if you're going to have anyone to do emotional labor for you. Otherwise, we're not strong enough friends for me to give you emotional labor. That right. is jerky.
Yeah.
And it creates alienation between us, and we're not building community doing that. RV values autonomy and dignity and these boundaries, but of individuals above all else. You know, it's anarchy. It places strong emphasis on consent, not just for respect, but to sexuality, but all aspects of relationships. So this is a powerful stand on relationship ethics that is certainly worthy of communist consideration. But this immediately raises the question of what kind of political commitments attend the values. So what she gets at, to summarize, is that relationship anarchism, the thing I just described, at least as a concept, is not really that subversive because it is a practice that's separate from community building. So in practice, you have what are called polycules. If you really want kind of a look into this lifestyles, there are these web comics. One is called Kimchi Cuddles.
Okay.
And there are some others, and you basically have someone talking about and making fun of their lifestyle. And they're fun because they're also genderqueer, and the art's kind of kooky because, like, they're not representing people
right
in a particular way. It's fun. Let's see. The language is not doesn't really have the potential of calling yourself an, you know, a what in the beginning. So what was this point about? That, oh yeah, it's kind of, it raises issues of like what you call your partners, your friends. There's all these different levels, but if you're trying to dissolve the separation of those levels, just like classes and the difference between poor and rich and black and white and identities, and try to actually take people as they come and relationships as they come, giving it this particular name to give it weight, you know?
Right.
Let's see. Political commitments come with practicing one's values. So the thing about most anarchism, not bashing all anarchism, of course.
Right.
Is you think if you listen to the show, I haven't like held up anarchist points of view in a while. I swear I have tendencies, anarchist tendencies, but that's where the syndicalism comes in.
Yeah.
And let's see. And I'm always skittish about like full state power and shit.
Yeah.
But you have this individualism that comes forward where people are just kind of, these are lifestyle choices. It's like buying granola and whatnot. And where's the political project? You know, where how is this? This isn't building community. So examples of relationship anarchy going bad. So she lists a very, you know, she practices it for a while and it gets really messy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work out well because of various issues that one can imagine. Let's see. RA is also sometimes abused because love is involved, or love is a resource that needs political work to be done to solve the issues. So there's a paragraph to, let's see. Here we go. In my personal experience, it was actually the next paragraph. I was always frustrated with many relationship anarchists who eschewed political anarchy. So they liked the free love aspects, but they weren't anarchists. They weren't doing mutual aid and community building. So it's not like you're dumping on anarchists for being anarchists. It's actually dumping on relationship anarchy and the people who do these things, being nonconforming, and they think they're so cool. And it's really just hipster culture.
Yeah.
I'm so cool doing this, but it's like, no, I won't join an org. I won't fight for a union. I'm okay. I got my trust fund, or I got my good tech job, whatever.
Yeah.
There are certainly entire cadre of relationship anarchists who are primarily white and hetero and insist on banal love is infinite slogans and refuse to take the conversation any further. There are white men who apparently go around collecting relationships with thin white women and call it radical and subversive, while lecturing queers and people of color who practice monogamy for not being radical enough. Not cool. There's also those who think RA is mainly about personal autonomy, like a Randian or an ANCAP, to such an extent that they truly believe that any person who asks for their emotional presence or asks them to do emotional labor or in general to attend to personal emotional needs of others is perceived as infringing on that person's autonomy. So this is the toxic individualism that occurs everywhere. And it's actually like, it could see, like, when I see sectarianism start, it starts with, you can't tell me what to do. Don't ask me to do things. You're infringing on my freedom or autonomy or my rights as
now
a woman.
You're sounding a lot like the anti-maskers.
It's exactly the same thing. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. You can't ask me to do emotional labor for you. What gives you the right to ask me for emotional labor? And it's like, because we're trying to build community here. It's like, oh, I don't need, you know, I didn't right. sign up for that.
You're free to say no, but I'm free to ask you to do something.
But also, like, the freedom, it's always about the negative freedom of right. don't infringe on me. If you're obsessed with that and not being infringed upon, not having commitments to others.
Right.
And I rail about this all the time because it comes up whenever toxicity starts. It's always "Don't tell me what to do, man."
Well, that sounds like ANCAPs, and they're just looking for an excuse to live on their own.
And it weaves among anarchist circles, yeah. and of course in any kind of circle, really, even authoritarian circles. It just becomes an authoritarianism of one.
Yeah,
of like it's my way or the highway. And maybe you'll have a group who then all agree on this. And there you have the group think or they're, you know, simpatico.
Yeah.
And then, okay, then they have a small community of 5 or 10 and they can get along. But then anyone else can't join or deviates. And then it's just all toxic. Because then it's like if this group and then you're if you this group wants to collaborate with our group, that they're infringing on us by asking us to take a position or be in solidarity with them. How dare they?
Right.
Without being Leninists themselves? Trash. You got to accept the immortal science of Maoism, or we can't go to the same protest. Or if we do, we're going to stand there silently and not talk to anyone.
Right.
Because they'll contaminate us. They'll infringe on us by asking, like, let's see. My intention is not to point fingers at the ways relationship anarchy as a paradigm is abused, but to unfairly critique it in terms of a few misguided adherents, but to think through its central concerns from a communist lens. I want to say that it is not a coincidence that this is so readily justified to abuse rhetoric, banal liberal identity politics, lifestyleism, and the evasion of ethical responsibility towards people around us. Love is abundant, yes, but it is not infinite. It is a tragically finite political resource. Political resource. As such, the ways, because, you know, who gives power and love and who gets love is something that is based on power. And this is something incels and others kind of understand, but they just kind of fall into the pit of, like, since I'm powerless now, I will be loveless forever. And I can't see any way of gaining power since I won't work with anyone.
Yeah.
Gaining power will require infringement on my rights. You got to break out of that first. Let's see. As communists, we take these constraints as part of any constraints to be part of the problem of relationships of production. So let's see. What I meant by that is to actually have free love from constraints of the current society, we actually have to struggle for that. And anarchists can't really deal with that. Or struggle anarchism. Anarchists who do struggle, do political work, they can't really deal with the constraints of society. Yeah. That would require taking the state or destroying it. And mutual aid does not do that. Not on its own. Mutual aid becomes a base for political struggle, and that's kind of where the theory and the thinking is at. So it's not like everyone who's doing mutual aid doesn't think there's a next step. Of course they do. The next step is unionizing. The next step is organizing.
Right.
But what forms does that take? To actually work with other people requires, quote-unquote, compromise. But I don't like the word compromise. It's more like or accommodation or sharing. It requires sharing. Sharing your emotional labor to communicate properly. The labor of reading books written from the point of view of your comrades.
Yeah.
Of if you're a Leninist, reading a Bakunin. If you're, if you're an anarchist, reading Stalin's work, he wrote a book too.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh. I didn't know that.
But it was later on.
Right.
Because as his rivals would say, he wasn't that smart.
Yeah.
But he was, he's a brute.
A stepbrother who's a Trotskyist, so that's kind of my lens of reference for.
But I mean, like the kind that we were talking about, where he's self-righteous about, like, Stalin's the worst. I mean, you can point out his mistakes, certainly. Like, I just watched a Time Ghost episode about World War II, where it's like everyone was telling him that Germany was going to invade. But in the same way that you don't challenge your meal ticket, that having certain beliefs of being having a paycheck requires you to believe certain things. Keeping his country together hinged on believing that he had more time.
Right.
And so we were always going to do whatever it takes to stall.
Yeah.
But he ran out of time, and everyone's telling him he was out of time, and he just had to put his fingers in his ears. Because if he, to mobilize, probably would have caused another famine or something. It would have caused a ton of problems. Then the country really would have fallen apart.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been able to resist at all. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's the way I kind of see it. Like, we're all slaves to the historical forces or something.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not that fatalistic. Definitely not. In fact, if I ever read fatalism like that, I always call it out. Like, there's this article. I don't think I'll read it. But it basically amounted to, like, Americans are dumb and work and, it's just like they're too dumb. We really can't, like, civilization's going to collapse and Now, I am the type that actually see positives in collapse, like this whole we can't really break out of the societal constraints, so we kind of need them to fall away.
Yeah.
And then we can actually work on some things. But we can prepare for when that happens, just as before other crashes like the Bronze Age. You had these experiments in technologies and mindsets, and you had radicals that were getting burned at the stake at the time for opposing the status quo. We don't get burned at the stake, but we do get canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not hired as a professional, let's say. Well, let's see. Was there anything else about that? No, just individualism itself. Let's see. The last paragraph, wrap up. Where she actually talks about what, like, relationship communism would be. My relationships in my community are not separate. My obligations to others extend beyond the people that I am having sex with. My feelings of love, including romantic affection, are a basis and resource for building community in communism, not just relationships. These feelings and values must be assessed and politicized towards building revolutionary communism. Let's see. So relationship communism, on the other hand, would respond that there is a need to draw a line between those existentially, politically committed to the survival of our movements in which to find ourselves, those who are not, and those who aren't. Communism sees that there are those fundamentally opposed to our flourishing as humans, and then we struggle against them, insofar as they are sustained by a commitment to building communism. Again, more words to say, to give a tautology of sorts. I feel more and more strongly the need to ask people whether or not they can commit, which is a strong word in relationship anarchy, not to me or to a particular relationship style, but to a way of life we co-create together. Commit to being a socialist, let's say. It is not enough for relationships to be consensual, though we must strive towards consent in all aspects. This is why I don't really see myself dating someone who doesn't share my political radicalism.
Yeah.
Because I always feel like there'll be this tension of like what I'm doing, what I want to build, and their priorities,
right,
that may conflict.
Yeah, I had a girlfriend who was
apolitical, let's say, and it's just like they're not into it, and it's like, well, if you're not into that, then you doesn't feel like you're into me. This is what I'm about. But that lowers my options. So she mostly talks about the failures, but mostly that, you know, this relationship communism would be then more about making a broader commitment.
Yeah.
And it's and having the meta skills of the communication and the consensuality and the, what do you call it, the love of diversity. Right. That's like, that we all kind of like when we're really nice to each other.
Yeah.
Just the ability to be nice is something that just doesn't seem to be taught well.
Right.
I mean, it's taught to some extent in kindergarten, learn how to share, but then it's not reinforced at all. By the next grade, it's all individual test taking.
Yeah.
And then any kind of conditioning of sharing and compassion is just all drilled away. And it's so frightening to see it in action and see it and just see how prevalent it is. And it's like, damn it, we're not going to make any progress because all the kids, they want to break out of it. They hate it.
Yeah.
But as far as everything they know and they do is all that, the bad stuff. Right. And it's like, it's going to be a lot of work to decommission. And it's like, they do want to do something different. That's what the new wave of protests are. But they just still aren't nice to each other. The sectarianism will bloom anew because of the middle skills and all that. First, my profound thanks for listening. An important skill is important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send in, ideas for the show, stories and topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage, but you can support the show via our Patreon page, Three Left Show. Support with your own time by telling others you believe would be interested, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts, all our episodes, which are also found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all podcasting apps. Full archive, with including show notes and links, can be found at thethreelefts.news. Of course, the most important thing is to put these ideas and thinking projects in practice yourself. Think about them before you go to bed. Thanks, and until next time, keep waving the flags of the Three Lefts. Any parting thoughts?
Cue the music.
Kill a kill music activated.